And our next matter, Ann M. Furcus, appellant versus Dana J. Harms, M.D., the respondent. Our file number is A190251. And as counsel is aware, each side will be allowed 15 minutes, five additional minutes for appellant. And I see appellant's anxious, ready to go. So I'll presume you're ready. If you want to identify yourself for the record, and then you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you. May it please the court, Nicholas Henry on behalf of appellant Ann M. Furcus. And yes, I am ready to go. And I'm going to try to speak slowly because I have a habit of speaking fast when I get excited. Let me tell you what I'm not here to do today. I'm not here to relitigate the matter of Statute 145-682 that came up the last time Ms. Furcus was in front of this court. This court issued a ruling on that, and while it didn't go in our favor, I understand and accept that ruling on when the clock starts on 145-682. But this court made a couple of other mentions in that opinion that were very relevant to this case here. One was that the statute was ambiguous, and two, that counsel had a reasonable interpretation of that ambiguous statute, counsel in this case being Mrs. Furcus, the appellant. And that was that when does the clock actually start? And the court ruled there that in an ambiguous statute, when there's two reasonable interpretations of this, that's ground for remand. So the court sent it back to the district court on to re-examine the issue of excusable neglect in light of their finding that the statute was ambiguous. Now, what happened after that was the court issued its ruling, and it takes some time for that to go through the district court process. I'd actually never had a case go to remand before, so I called another attorney who was experienced and said, what do I do here? He said, the district court sets it up. So Colin set up a hearing, and the district court handles it from there. While I was doing that, the respondent filed for a summary judgment again. I canceled the hearing I set up and responded to their summary judgment motion again, and we went back to hearing in October of last year. At that hearing, and this is where the question before this court comes in, is what is the scope on remand that the district court is bound to follow?
Here's a question for you.
Sure.
In light of the fact that the hearing, I mean, it is confusing to me when I looked at the record and saw that there's a summary judgment argument, which seems to be a bit of a divergence from the remand instruction. It seems to me that our reversal kept the case alive. Summary judgment was filed. One way to look at this is that whatever the remand order is doesn't really matter. Now our question is summary judgment appropriate based upon the facts that were established and presented to the district court at the time, given that you withdrew your hearing request on the remand?
That's a fair question, and I think the way I would answer it is that the two are inextricably intertwined. Because the issue of excusable neglect was still up on the summary judgment consideration, and that was still up for remand, and the question of whether the reasonableness of the excusable neglect had never been considered by the district court. The analysis started and stopped at there was no affidavit. There was no examination or analysis whatsoever as to why there was no affidavit. What series of events before the initial dismissal in 2017 led up to there being no affidavit?
Let me touch
that's an integral part of the excusable neglect claim.
Understandable. Let me... I've got troubles in this case from a number of perspectives, but it seems to me that while it's ambiguous, as this court determined, as to when the clock began for the purposes of the expert affidavit, at least ambiguous before we issued our opinion,
yep.
Now it's not ambiguous to anybody, not reasonably ambiguous. Is there any ambiguity to the rules governing your client's power to initiate the meeting, which in turn begins the discovery, which in turn provides the evidence and factual basis for the expert affidavit?
I think to answer that, there's the rules and there's how law gets practiced. And in practice, the rules are waived and agreed to extensions by counsel all the time.
My question is as to the rules.
Okay.
Is there any ambiguity in the rules that your client had a duty to, notwithstanding the mutual duty of your opposing counsel, had a duty to initiate the discovery process within a defined period of time?
And in that question, to answer that question, I would argue no, because the rule for discovery conference says the parties must confer. It doesn't put any bonus on one party or the other. It says the parties both must get together. Either party can initiate.
Right. So both parties have the duty to initiate.
I would agree.
So do you agree that you, as representative of your client in the district court, had a duty to initiate those proceedings that would have led to the discovery, which you say is what was necessary for the expert affidavit to be created?
I would agree that under your example, I did have a duty, and so, as did the respondent. However, going back to what I was saying about the practicality of it, when this case first started, counsel for the respondent asked for an extension on his answer, and I gladly admitted that, or granted that. And at the same time, he requested authorizations for medical records. And when I contacted the respondent's attorney a month later about that, I said, I'm still working on getting the authorizations. And I've noted this in the record several times, and it's never been addressed in any stage of litigation. There was no response from counsel for the respondent to that.
No response to what?
To my saying, I'm still working on these authorizations.
Why would he need to? What would be the need for responding to that? You were requested information. You had a requirement, an obligation under the rules to move the case forward for your client, and you asked for more time to do something else. Why would? What is the basis that you're arguing that there's some implied obligation to respond to your saying, I don't have it yet?
I wasn't the one asking for something else. The counsel for the respondent was. They were asking for authorizations, and I was trying to get them from my client. It's a long story about why that didn't happen, but it's really irrelevant. We didn't get them for quite some time.
Right, so why is it? What's the obligation to respond to your saying, we don't have it yet?
Common courtesy would just say, all right, well, let's move forward with this.
What does that have to do with the obligation to begin, as this court determined, that there was this was so long it's clear that discovery would have occurred and should have occurred, and the requirement for the commencement of discovery was long since passed. There's no ambiguity in that rule. I'm not sure how this discussion of whether or not there are authorizations provided have any bearing whatsoever on the obligation of both parties.
Again, it goes to the rule that both parties are responsible for this, not simply one party. And I understand your point, and
no,
yes, we could have initiated.
Both parties may be responsible for it, but in this case, the burden is on you to show that your contribution to the failure supports reasonable neglect. How is your neglect reasonable if it is unambiguous that you had the power to commence the discovery process that would have gotten you the information, that would have afforded the opportunity to inform an expert, to provide the expert affidavit, which was never provided?
Because with the one-year limitation, or with the one-year time frame for pocket filing, which is what happened here, I took that non-response as a waiver of the 30-day requirement. Now, maybe that was a mistake on my part.
It seems from doesn't our decision in the previous appeal establish that was a mistake on your part?
Yes, it does, but hindsight's 20/20.
Well, the hindsight was based upon an unambiguous rule.
But it still goes.
I mean, hindsight is 20/20, but foresight was 20/20 based on the language of the rule, isn't it?
And again, I would simply say that, you know, between the May conversation with counsel and again in July, where there was also no response, where I said, hey, look, what do we want to do here? Let's, you know, I asked him in a voicemail. I don't have a record of that, obviously, because it was a voicemail I left to him. I said, what do we want to do here? There was no response to that voicemail either. Twice we reached out to him. Twice there was no response back.
Your inquiries about your voicemails had nothing to do, as I understand your representation, had zero to do with the initiation of discovery. It was about authorizations.
Well, I would argue that, you know, saying I'm still working on these authorizations, we've got more claims coming up, what do you want to do here? That's at least opening the door. I mean, maybe I could have used the precise words, let's initiate a discovery conference, but it was an offhand phone voice message to opposing counsel. And it was based, again, on my belief at the time that we were not under a clock and that we had time under the pocket filing rule to initiate discovery when the parties meet and confer.
That may have been your understanding, but it seems to me, based upon what this court said about the unambiguous rule, that's not a reasonable understanding, that discovery was going to be indefinitely delayed. it seems to me.
Okay.
I mean, do you agree or disagree?
No, I understand where you're coming from. I would say that's it's certainly understandable in light of what happened, and you might have a different opinion on that, but just practicality of the matter, counsel waive time periods all the time. It's standard practice, and usually there's an agreement on it, but when one side refuses to communicate, the other side, I don't think it's unreasonable to assume that that's a waiver at that point. And I also don't think it's in any way reasonable for opposing counsel to just sit and wait and hope that a time limit expires when they also have a duty to meet and confer.
Once this court ruled the first time, and now you have the benefit of that decision and knew that your client needed to respond to the elements of the excuse, I want to focus in particular on there is a reasonable defense on the merits, which seems inextricably tied to the issue, of course, underlying the entire litigation, as the expert affidavit had not yet been filed. What basis would this court have to find that the trial court erred in concluding, because of the lack of the affidavit, even to the judge's words were to this day, the day of the hearing, he could not conclude there's a reasonable defense on the merits because the very affidavit, which would provide that, wasn't there?
I think in part to answer your question, you have to ask why there was no affidavit. In other part to answer your question, the judge notes that there is a preliminary report provided by the expert witness in which she lays out she believes that it is a violation of the standard of care. But now that report was not in an expert witness affidavit format, nor was it intended to be. That was for the benefit of counsel. It would have been impossible for us to have submitted this effective and properly formatted affidavit, because let's be honest, an affidavit is a product of discovery, especially an expert witness affidavit. As I pointed out in my brief by the American Pediatrics Association, the expert needs to have access to all the documents and all the information before they can issue their opinion. That only comes through discovery. That comes through written discovery, and it comes through testimonial discovery, neither of which can start with it before a discovery conference can be initiated. Now, in getting back to your question, that's the why there was no affidavit. But the court, because there couldn't have been, there was no discovery. Perhaps discovery should have started. That may be an issue in this. But the fact of the matter is discovery didn't start, and that is the fault of both parties. Had discovery gone on, and we'd not been under the mistaken belief that we weren't under this deadline for the 145-682 statute, we would have initiated those. We would have sent out written discovery, we would have received it, we would have gone through depositions. We didn't do that because we didn't believe we were under the time clock to do that at that time.
Once you became aware from this court's decision that you were under a time clock, and your opponent, instead of waiting for the hearing that you were presenting on the remand issue, brought a motion for summary judgment, what prevented you from, at that time, indicating to opposing counsel that you wanted discovery, that you were commencing this meeting that hadn't occurred before, so that you can get the discovery?
I appreciate that question, and I laid that out in my brief. Brzezinski, citing Elways, is pretty clear that Minnesota law says that once a case is dismissed with prejudice, as Ms. Ferkus's case was at that initial dismissal, the district court has no further involvement with it.
Well, unless this court reverses, which this court did.
This court did reverse it, but I still had no authority to initiate discovery at that time. The district court had no obligation to compel discovery. We had, and the time frame of it simply is impractical. It was 6 months is anticipated for discovery under the statute in order to be able to get enough information to submit a proper affidavit. We had from July through October, and that was only because of the time frame set up by the summary judgment. There was 30 days for written discovery on one end, 30 days on the other end, and then time to set up depositions after that. It would have been a pretty tight squeeze to get that in, had we even been able to compel them to go to discovery.
It seems like your argument is that the district court and the parties simply lacked any authority after the case was dismissed except to respond to the remand from this court.
According to what my understanding of the law is, yes.
Did you make that argument to the district court when you received the summary judgment? Did you respond to summary judgment by saying, Your Honor, the summary judgment, this motion is out of bounds? This court has only one thing before it right now, which is to address the remand from the Court of Appeals. The case is legally dead otherwise, and you can't consider summary judgment.
In my motion in response to their summary judgment, I did make that argument to the court.
Well, you made the argument that the case was legally dead so that you couldn't you lack the power to go and present the expert affidavit, but did you make the argument that the case is legally dead so that the district court cannot rule on the summary judgment?
In my mind, they were one and the same.
How would the court know what's in your mind without you making the argument specifically to the district court?
Again, to me, it seems self-evident that once the case is up for remand, the district court should only be considering what's up for remand.
Well, it may be self-evident, but if you don't make the argument, have you preserved the issue as to a remedy for a self-evident failure?
I believed I made that argument and preserved it for whatever the record needed to be. I don't know if you would agree with that, but that was my belief at the time that I'd made that argument sufficiently.
And what was it in your, what were the words in your argument that would establish that you made it sufficiently?
That the case was legally dead and the court had no authority to consider it beyond remand. I don't know if I believe I used those words.
I thought the argument you made was that the case was legally dead and therefore you had no power to provide an expert affidavit until the court ruled on the remand issue. I thought that was your argument to the district.
It was, but by me having no power, that also includes the court not having the power to do it, to compel them to participate in discovery. And again, I probably could have worded that better, but that was my argument at the time as I was making it. Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel for respondent, you may approach and proceed.
May it please the court and counsel. I'd like to begin by sharing with the court.
Can I ask you to identify yourself first?
I'm sorry, I forgot my name. Mark Whitmore, Bassford Remley. I'm here on behalf of the respondent, Dr. Dana Harms. If I could, I'd like to begin by sharing with the court a line from the April 2018 decision of this court in the underlying matter. In this case, Judge Jessen wrote, "This process of acquiring an expert witness can be done outside of discovery, and therefore determining that the 180-day period does not begin until the discovery conference takes place would allow plaintiffs to have an extended amount of time to communicate with and find an expert witness." That's on page 420 of this court's decision.
And find an expert witness, but the deficiency that the district court based its decision on in summary judgment after remand was not merely the identification of the expert, but the failure to provide a substantive affidavit as to the basis for the expert's opinion, which, according to this court and the rule and the statute, there seems to be a basis for that affidavit after there's discovery, and that's worded into the statute, it's included in the rule.
Right, I think that what as I read that language from the court, it says you don't just need to do depositions. You can get your affidavit by having your client or your expert review the medical records, do those types of things to evaluate. It happens all the time. And in fact, it happened in this case. Counsel signed a certification of expert review before even starting this case in March of 2016. Saying that he had reviewed this case with an expert who was going to testify that there had been a violation of the standard of care and causation. So we know that it began. The problem is this is a...
You agree, don't you, that what this court said in the previous appeal and what the statute says and the rule changes accommodate is the notion that the expert affidavit, the substantive expert affidavit, is to be provided after the plaintiff has had the opportunity for discovery to inform the expert.
That's certainly part of the equation. I don't know that I would agree with you that it goes that far, Your Honor, because it can happen, and it does happen all of the time, that expert affidavits.
Well, it can happen, but the right that's included in the statute ties to the discovery opportunity.
Right, and I think Judge Burke's frustration in this case, if you read the transcript, it goes to one of the elements of this four-part test on excusable neglect, is did counsel act with due diligence after learning of the error? And I think what Judge Burke said, and he asked counsel several times at the oral argument, he said, but you did nothing. You did nothing here. He did nothing after when I requested the affidavit in my answer. in November of 2016 when I sent him an email and said, I don't think you're in compliance here.
What was the instruction on remand? And did the district court limit itself or actually answer the question that was presented on remand by this court?
As I read the Court of Appeals decision in this case, what it said was, Judge Burke, you made findings on reasonable excuse because this was a complicated interpretation of the statute, but you didn't have the chance to make findings on the other three elements of excusable neglect.
Neglect to do what?
Excusable neglect in terms of the reasons why he failed to comply with the statute, in terms of getting an expert and providing an expert affidavit.
So wasn't the remand instruction, remand based upon the fact that there had been a failure before the dismissal to provide the affidavit?
Yes.
So on remand, didn't our court specifically ask for the analysis of reasonable neglect for that failure, the providing of the affidavit before the dismissal?
I think that's fair, Judge.
It seems like the district court, though, analyzed not the provision of the affidavit, the reasonable neglect of the affidavit at that time, but then based the decision on neglect that occurred after this court issued its ruling, without ever issuing a finding as to the reasonableness of the neglect before the dismissal.
I think it was actually two parts. I think I maybe misspoke in response to your earlier question. I think that the point that Judge Burke raised was, look, one of the issues here is due diligence after finding about the error. And the error was disclosed in November of 2016. It was disclosed again in January of 2017. And even after this court issued its decision in April of 2018, nothing had happened. And what Judge Burke was looking for, I think, was questions of counsel. What have you done? Did you talk with Dr. Hamilton to get an affidavit? There's nothing in the record. Did you serve an interrogatory? There's nothing in the record. Did you request a discovery conference? Did you do anything? So I think the district court's issue and fair concern was there's nothing happening here. There can't be excusable neglect unless there has been efforts to act with due diligence, such as...
Don't you agree, though, that Judge Burke's analysis was, and the conclusion, was based upon a failure to act after receiving notice by this court?
I think it was also part from receiving notice even back in November of 2016 in the email that I sent to counsel saying you haven't complied with the statute here. I think that's when the notice began. And I think Judge Burke looked at that whole process, Judge, in terms of when things happened, why things happened, and this long timeline that expanded over 3 years, now has expanded over 3 years, for the plaintiff to do anything to move their case forward.
Here's the problem I've got with your argument that I'm trying to get my mind around. It seems that you're arguing that the plaintiff can't have reasonably been neglectful in failing to provide an expert affidavit because the failure to provide the expert affidavit is a per se establishment that there is no reasonable excuse.
No,
District Court seems to have said that there's no that there's we don't have an affidavit from you from your expert, therefore you can't establish that there was a reasonable case on the merits. But what the district court was being asked to do by this court was to determine whether or not the failure to provide that expert affidavit to begin with was the result of reasonable neglect.
Right. It
feels circular to me.
Yeah, I understand. I think our hang up, Judge Ross, is that remember there's four elements here. And I think that on the reasonable excuse element, I think you're exactly right. There was confusion, and in fact, this court addressed that. And Judge Burke, he didn't reach his conclusions to grant summary judgment based upon that element.
In fact, the that element, the district court decided in favor of the plaintiff.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. But there's three other elements. You know, the one is which I think Judge Sleater referenced was they need to show that there's a reasonable that there's a reasonable likelihood of success on the merits. And our position there is, well, get an affidavit. And that part, that to your point, I can see why you say that might be a little bit circular. But let's talk about the due diligence issue then. The due diligence issue after the plaintiff has notice of being not out of compliance, and we can look at it on two different dates to initiate that. I would suggest to you that that date began in November 30 of 2016 when I sent him an email saying, Nick, you're out of compliance here. What should have happened at that point was, well, look, I'm going to talk to this doctor. We need to get this going. I form a record. Do something. That never happened. That's not due diligence. Counsel, if you read within our brief, their argument, they talk about, Mr. Henry talks about, well, he thinks that the time for evaluating when due diligence began was when we first noticed the motion for dismissal in January of 2017, a year and a half ago, and still nothing happened. That was a year and a half before the summary judgment motion that's at issue now. Nothing happened. Not an interrogatory, not a discovery conference, not a document, not a deposition, nothing.
Mr. Whitmer, can I ask about that? And it kind of goes to Judge Ross's first question in this line, is that now that this court has ruled that the excusable neglect should have been considered, let's just presume hypothetically Judge Burke then at the same hearing before we even got the case the first time is addressing excusable neglect. Obviously, does that we're just looking from that time prior to failing to file, correct?
You're right.
If we're looking at that time period, and one of the elements is the reasonable defense on the merits, we know we don't have an affidavit. Wouldn't it have been reasonable for the judge to consider that letter, which seems to have the elements that the statute would require, but absent the affidavit, consider the arguments, perhaps allow a brief additional discovery period since that's being requested, since that on its face, together with the complaint, has at least a prima facie level. So now we're here for excusable neglect. Let's allow some reasonable time, see if the affidavits, and then come back. It still isn't filed. Well, now you have a different situation, or perhaps it is.
And that's a fair question, but it would be contrary to what the Supreme Court has said and what this court has said, because what you would be in essence doing is you would be allowing a letter to serve as establishing that, satisfying the statute, in essence, is what you would be doing in that situation. And I've given the court at least three or four cases within our brief which talk about the decisions which say that's not enough. This is a statute that requires strict compliance. The Supreme Court has told us that in the Lindbergh case, in the Sorensen case, Anderson versus Rengachari.
That's the problem we've got, is that the district court seemed to have based its decision on the failure to adhere to the strict compliance of the statute. When the district court was asked on remand to analyze whether or not there is a reasonable neglectful failure to adhere to the statute, and that's the circular part that I'm lost on. I mean, I'd feel differently if the district court would have analyzed it further and said something about the letter that was provided.
Sure.
But instead, just seemed to base it on the argument that you're making, which is, the statute says you had to provide this and you didn't provide it, therefore you lose, even though the question before the district court was your failure to provide that affidavit to meet the statute, was that failure reasonably neglectful so that it can be excused?
Right. And again, I understand the concept you're talking about, but again, the elements are also interrelated. And by that I mean the due diligence element is part of what you're talking about as well, and whether the plaintiff acted with due diligence. And again, the record lacks even one thing of doing any discovery to get to that point, if that's truly what he needed. And I question whether that's necessary to get an affidavit, particularly when he's obviously talking with a physician already who, and Judge Sleater, I disagree a little bit about whether that, while that letter does say standard of care, if you look at it, also talks about known complications, and I question whether that would be sufficient anyways. But again, we keep coming back to the same issue about the third point, which is due diligence. And the fourth element, which we haven't talked about at all, is the prejudice to Dr. Harms. And this is one that Judge Burke did not agree with me on. But I would submit that he did not, if you look at his order, he did not talk about the cases which have come down on this issue. They're within my brief.
Counsel, is the issue of prejudice in front of this panel? I mean, did you file a notice of related?
I don't know that we need to have file a formal notice of appeal with I think with the excusable neglect going up.
Well, if you're asking us to reverse the judge's finding on prejudice.
I don't know that you need to have a separate notice of appeal because I think you can affirm on an independent ground related to that same issue, Judge.
Well, I think the case law is clear that we could affirm on an independent ground if the district court hadn't decided that question. But the district court did decide that issue against your client, and your client has not formally challenged that finding on that element. And you may be right. The district court may have been wrong about it, but I'm curious about your response to Judge Kalatowski's question in light of the fact that, generally speaking, issues are waived if you don't get have a related.
And I think that the litigating the question of excusable neglect waive, I think in a different interpretation of that same element, I don't believe we needed to file a formal notice of appeal on that. The last thing I'd like to, just as the court is aware, I think, is a reminder that this is a standard of review case. The question on standard of review, back starting with the Cole versus Wetzke case, the GAMS, is did the district court, has there been a clear abuse of discretion? The decision in this case from 2018 said that the district court is in the best position to make those decisions. I submit to you that there is undisputed evidence to stand by Judge Burke's decision, and it asks that the decision below be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, if you wish, you may have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you again, Your Honors. You brought up an excellent point, Your Honor, about what the district court had options available, or what options the district court had available. Case law is pretty clear that when there's an absence of an affidavit with a statute, the case should be dismissed. It's draconian, but that's the proper response. But that doesn't consider why wasn't an affidavit submitted, and we've already gone over this, and we don't need to hash over it again in the last 4.5 minutes. But that was one option the district court had. Another option would have been an extension of time, or say, hey, he's got this letter that says there could be a reasonable basis here. Let's give you some time for discovery and sort this out. That was an option available to the district court. The district court chose not to take that. They chose the most draconian possible measure and complete dismissal.
Counsel, on remand, the district court was to determine excusable neglect. One element was due diligence. How could the district court have found that you have exercised due diligence in this process? Respondents pointed out you did nothing.
Well, counsel likes to point out that I like to start the due diligence clock at the time I received initial notice in November, and I think that's a very fair place to start that, because as this court already has held, we were under a reasonable mistaken interpretation of the statute, and every action we took was based on that reasonable but mistaken interpretation of the statute. Now, when counsel reached out to us and said, I think you're not in compliance with this statute, I responded back and said, the statute says before the commencement of discovery hasn't commenced, I don't think we're under the clock here. That was the first response that I gave. And then the next time I knew there might not be compliance was when he filed his motion to dismiss in January. Now, we were still within the one-year time period for filing this case. And as soon as the case gets filed in court, then, yeah, we're just going to go with the clock. Before this, there's a more informal process that can happen among attorneys when they're trying to get this case started.
What was the evidence of your due diligence to commence the discovery process that you are pointing out was necessary to the filing of the affidavit?
I would love to give you evidence on the record. I can't. The only thing I can tell you is there was a phone conversation when talking about the hearing that was coming up for the initial dismissal. I asked if we wanted to do a discovery conference, and he said, let's wait till after the dismissal hearing. That's not on the record, so obviously you can't consider it, but that's a fact that in this case that...
Well, after the dismissal hearing, but what was the... Before the breach, I think the question is before the neglect in failing to provide the affidavit, what was the evidence that was provided to the district court? I mean, on remand, what evidence did you provide to the district court to show that your efforts were diligent to commence the discovery process?
On remand, my argument to the district court was that they should only consider what had happened up to the time of the initial dismissal, and that anything after that would be improper because the case was legally dead. That was my position.
Okay, so what was the evidence that you provided that up before the initial dismissal, you had engaged in a process that would have commenced the discovery that would have informed you sufficient to provide an expert affidavit?
I submitted on the record an email to counsel and then again to the court, the letter from the expert that I discussed with laying out her opinion. And I gave that to counsel and the district court as soon as he filed it. I said, here's this.
But counsel, you've acknowledged that that's not enough to support an affidavit.
I have, but
so
I also-
the court looked at due diligence at that point, what else did you do?
But again, we're stuck on the was there an affidavit. We're not looking at why there wasn't an affidavit. I acknowledge that this was not a sufficient affidavit.
Well, not just
affidavit.
Why there wasn't, but whether you exercised due diligence to get an affidavit. And regardless, I mean, perhaps the court looked at it after a remand, but even going back, which the court would have had to look at, what is your due diligence as of that point? Other than your mistaken interpretation of the statute, what else did you do?
The due diligence was the best I could do between the time the notice of hearing was filed and the time the hearing would happen. There was no time for discovery.
No, not from the time the notice of hearing was filed. From the from the time that you became aware that you had an obligation under the, well, let me take it another way. It seems to me from our court's description of what was clear in the rules is that both parties unambiguously were on notice that you could commence the discovery process. Both parties were obligated to do so. So why don't we look at diligence? Shouldn't we look at diligence, your diligence, from that moment on, as opposed to after our court issued its decision or you received notice from opposing counsel?
That's an option this court has. I can't tell you how to look at this. I can only tell you how I would prefer you would look at it.
No, I understand that. But is there any reason under the law why we should look at it?
Because again, you're punishing one party for an obligation both parties shared, and I don't think that's fair.
Thank you, counsel, for your comments and to.
Thank you for your time, Your Honors. That was a very challenging examination.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel and for your briefing. We appreciate that as well. We will take the matter under advisement. Do have a good day.